Salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Friday, April 20th of the year 2018. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who's glad to be back with you once again, and we are glad to be your soundtrack for this weekend. If you've been partaking of anything on the day that this is released, 420, that means something to some people. Others, it's just the end of a work week. For whatever it means to you, we're so glad that you can join us once again.
Indeed, and I'm the other voice on this program. This week I am Dennis, the man who thinks that Billy Mitchell himself is making it impossible to feel even a little bit sorry for Billy Mitchell.
A continuation of your nickname from last week when we spoke and at length, actually, about the news of Billy Mitchell and his banishment from the Twin Galaxies record books.
Yes, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Billy in the actual news portion of the show this week, because more stuff has happened, and, well, we're going to have more to talk about. But instead of clouding up too much of the intro of the show with him, because a lot of the show is going to be with him, yeah, basically, yeah, it's just... every time he speaks, it just gets worse.
Talk about someone getting in their own way.
Yeah.
But we will get to that in great substance and detail in just a couple minutes. No doubt you have many thoughts to share on the Billy Mitchell matter, as do I. And I'm sure our listeners are intrigued to hear what we have to say on that. So we shall get to that in short order. But before we get there, we must get to... before we forget and get carried away, such as last week, we will get to the ludicrous leadoffs, the two news items that have come across our collective and respective wires that have struck us as just being a little bit extra special, kind of special.
Yeah, this first one has been sort of that on the internet for... it's been sort of a saga a bit on a couple of the gaming news sites and Reddit for the better part of the last week. Wherein Julian Turner, who is a collector of retro video games, posted a very interesting find, to say the least, on Reddit, and basically posted the whole saga that happened, because there was a saga that happened, including law enforcement involvement and all sorts of stuff. And basically, the whole thing started when he thought he was picking up, you know, a couple of games, roller games and golf, for the NES.
Yeah, he bought them used at a flea market.
Yeah, he, I think it was one of those cases where he wasn't going to necessarily pick something up, but he noticed that the version of roller games was a PAL version, which isn't something you'd normally see in Georgia, which is where Julian Turner is. So he also noticed that the cartridges felt a little bit heavy, and he weighed them on digital scales, and he found that both games were about 50% heavier than they should have been.
Which is actually substantive for an NES game. They are very light, normally.
Yeah. So for one to feel like it's almost two, that is kind of cause for alarm. So he did what any collector or anyone who's just kind of curious would have done. He cracked the games open to see what was going on. Like, maybe there might have been some weird corrosion going on, I don't know, some sort of oxidization. I'm not a scientist, I don't know what would necessarily reasonably cause games to start weighing more. Maybe they had a whole extra game jammed in there, like maybe they were one of those, maybe it was had one of those weird games that you would sometimes see back in the day where they had that weird conversion piece where it was actually a Famicom game that was clicked into a converter, and then inside that converter the whole monstrosity was put inside a game. Who knows? It's a reasonable thing to want to open it up. But when he opened it up, his heart sank and he realized he had to call the cops, basically. And why was that?
Well, he found something you really would never expect to find in an old NES game cartridge. He found shiny plastic bags, which should not be there. If you open up an NES casing for a cartridge, it should just be empty. It should be air. It should be negative space in the, you know, major body of the cartridge. Really, all the weight is at the very bottom of the cartridge where the circuit board and connectors are, to connect the cartridge to the NES system. But he found two in each, four total shiny plastic bags that looked like drugs. And turns out, yes, they were drugs. They were illicit narcotics which had been stashed in there by someone or something or some sort of entity that were put in there for the purposes of moving them about and having them not be noticed in also a very more conspicuous manner than just having them open in your car or what have you.
Yeah.
And understandably, and to his credit, Julian Turner did the right thing by calling his local police department. And so officers from the Noonan Police Department in his part of Georgia answered the call to come investigate. They came to his house, and Julian Turner actually has video of everything. Video not just of his dismantling of the NES cartridges, but also video of the police arriving at his house to basically respond to the call of found drugs, and documented everything, which we link to on our website, thearcadeshow.com, and you can watch it for yourself. I mean, it's not always the most interesting thing, but certainly credit to him for having the video there, because that's an awkward phone call, I'm sure, to make, and an awkward encounter and visit to have with the police when you phone them and say, hey, I found drugs in this thing. They're going to look at you with some degree of suspicion.
Well, if anything else, too, him having the video is all he needs to basically indicate to the cops, hey, this is... They aren't mine. I'm not trafficking these. These are all yours. All I was doing was buying games at a flea market. I have the whole thing documented for my YouTube channel, presumably, or whatever. I didn't do editing yet. Here's the video if you need it. And they're probably going to go, yeah, yeah, you're just some nerdy kid. Fine, cool, whatever. We believe you. But yeah, the officers from the, well, actually the officers didn't say necessarily, but it sounded like from, I guess, the general consensus, these weren't fresh drugs. Those drugs had been there for a while. Especially, I mean, if someone was aware of them, they would have not have made it to a flea market and get sold for a flea market price for NES games. Surely the drugs would have been worth a lot more than whatever game it was. Even if it's a rare PAL version of Roller Games, I'm sure. If it was, I don't know, heroin or something, like, yeah. But yes, that's a...
Now, if you're wondering what exactly it was that were in the, what drugs were in the shiny foil packages, stuff inside the NES cartridges, it was never overtly stated, but a police report obtained by the New York Post indicated that the baggies were filled with a sandy glass or crystalline substance.
Yeah. Which literally could describe almost any powdery kind of drug, right?
Yeah, so it wasn't weed.
No. No, it wasn't.
But obviously put there by somebody who knew what they were doing, but somehow got mixed up along the way. Perhaps somebody back in the day was, you know, just using these to bring their games over to a friend's house to play Nintendo, which of course for them would have been code for transacting drugs.
Yeah. But, as Luke Plunkett from Kotaku, made the interesting comment, he just kind of let his imagination run wild in his report of this. And he was saying, I wonder how that happened. Maybe there was an innocent mix up at some drug dealer's home where a kid already owned a copy of Golf, which then led to a tense 1986 standoff at a Brussels airport as a burly man with a thick mustache opened an NES game expecting drugs and instead found an NES game.
That may have happened.
Yeah, so it's entirely possible that those drugs have been there for 30 years.
Possible. It's obviously whoever actually owned the NES games or the copies of Roller Games and Golf before Mr. Julian Turner picked them up, didn't know what the hell was in there and never occurred to them that it might be drugs in there or that they should investigate, because, which is actually kind of weird, because if you pick up an NES cartridge and feel that it's heavier than normal, wouldn't you normally look inside?
Well, it's also entirely possible that it was one of those cases where maybe, you know, a wife or a girlfriend or some kids or some friend or something was clearing out someone's stuff. Maybe someone passed on. Maybe they just wanted to get rid of a bunch of crap. And they just kind of maybe gave this, you know, a whole box full of NES games away. Who knows? I mean, it's really hard to say how things end up at flea markets and stuff, or like, you know, the lives that some of these things have gone through, basically, because, you know, like, at this point, if you're buying an NES game, it's entirely possible that it's seen some shit. But
this is true. You're coming to it at a very later point in its life cycle, when it's been passed around maybe a dozen times, if not more, in its life cycle, and God only knows what it's seen. And whenever you buy an old game, there's always an element of buyer beware and caution you should enter into it with, because you don't know what you're getting.
Oh, of course. You also don't know the status of it. I mean, I'm sure both of us have bought used NES games before that just don't work.
I'm lucky enough to say never had that with an NES game, although a GameCube game, of all things, I did buy it one time, and it did not work.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah.
Yeah, you take your chances if you're buying used.
Yeah, exactly. But, who knows what the actual story there is. It definitely could be the great jumping off point for a piece of speculative fiction.
I'm seeing a screenplay. I'm sensing movie treatment.
Yeah, I mean,
hey, the 90s are back in fashion, basically a 90s type movie about some ace video game kid player who unknowingly is also a drug runner for some sort of cartel.
Yeah. I mean,
and he has to keep winning at games and whatever to keep his family alive?
Maybe. What actually probably happened was it's entirely possible that some drug dealers saw the rise in, you know, retro gaming and using like NES games and stuff as collectibles, and maybe saw this as an opportunity and an easy way to maybe ship something that's less conspicuous, you know, like wrapping it in like some sort of metallic foil or whatever would have made it look kind of just like maybe a battery pack or something inside like an X-ray when going through. When people open up, it's like, oh, it's an NES game. Yeah, okay. Those things had all sorts of weird electronics inside them. Here we go. And if it was packed tight enough that, you know, no scent or whatever got out, it would have been almost pretty easy. I bet.
True enough. And to an untrained eye, if someone is not accustomed to looking at the inside of an NES cartridge or with any reasonable idea of what the inside of an NES cartridge should look like, then just having those blocks come up on the X-ray scan, if that were to happen, yeah, I can see them just writing it off as, oh, onboard electronics or something. Whereas you or I, or, you know, those who have been involved in the video game scene for many years from the NES day, know that as soon as you open it up, it's all empty.
Yeah, like it should be all pretty much empty, with, you know, save for the little PCB board inside.
But that is certainly something that I guess you can somewhat get away with in old games. Probably, if that's a thing you're going for, then the NES cartridge is your best form factor to use, because it had the most available space inside. Sega games didn't have as much. Super Nintendo games, not so much. And then, of course, as you move on through time, discs have none.
Yeah, though some maybe Atari and Coleco games had, maybe you would have been able to do something with. They had a nice kind of shape inside them.
True too. Very good point. But as time has gone on, the ubiquity of physical cartridges has, of course, decreased. The rise of disc and now digital gaming has just increased exponentially. And a game that you would certainly not be able to run drugs with is one of the big titles coming out later this year, Spider-Man on the PlayStation 4. And our second ludicrous lead-off is just a bizarre story that struck me as being... I don't know if it qualifies as meta, possibly a snake coming around and eating its own tail. We'll leave it for you to decide, but as we've talked about in recent weeks, Spider-Man on PlayStation 4 coming out in September to the PlayStation 4 is when it's released. And, you know, there's the usual accoutrement around it of special editions, collector editions, but news coming out just a couple days ago that there's going to be tie-in books to the Spider-Man PlayStation 4 video game. There's going to be two of them, and you might think, okay, well, some sort of making of the game or behind the scenes or an art book with, you know, pieces of concept art for the game. And yeah, one of those is going to be an art book. But another one is going to be a book that actually tells the lead-up to the story of Spider-Man on PlayStation 4. It's going to be an actual novel of the events that lead up to Spider-Man on PlayStation 4, and it's called Spider-Man Hostile Takeover. So yes, the Spider-Man PlayStation game is getting a physical book. Now, when I read this story, and I couldn't help but think, wouldn't that just be the comics?
Unless it's like a novel. It's entirely possible it's like a novel, which is even weirder, because, I mean, it started out as a comic. It's going to, you know, it's seen, you know, adaptations, it's seen movies, it's seen video games. It's weird that it's going through an adaptation back into a more primitive, well, not a primitive form of book, but, you know, a more traditional form of book, certainly than a graphic novel or comic book is, if that's the case.
Certainly, and it's all to tie into a more advanced medium, which is a video game.
Yeah.
Which is a much more interactive experience than simply sitting down and reading a novel.
Yeah. But, I mean, given that the author is David Liss, who is also known for doing things like The Ethical Assassin and, you know, The Man Without Fear, The Black Panther, you know, it's probably going to be a comic of some kind. Which, still, I mean, but in a way, though, what better way to promote a Spider-Man non-comic thing than to put out a comic to kind of, you know, tie people into it? Because there are people that still like to read comics and people that like to collect comics and stuff. And perhaps this is, you know, Insomniac Games extending an olive branch to the people that like comics to be like, hey, we have a comic for you. Want to try our game?
That's entirely possible. The announcement, the press release put out by Titan Books, who are publishing the Spider-Man Hostile Takeover and the art book, says, quote, leading directly into the beginning of the game, Marvel's Spider-Man Hostile Takeover features some of Spidey's most famous friends and foes, including the Shocker, Echo, the Blood Spider, J. Jonah Jameson, Mary Jane Watson, and Wilson Fisk, a.k.a. the Kingpin. And apparently this new book will detail Kingpin's plan to gain an iron grip on New York City and establish the characters and connections between the characters ahead of the game. So if you were to read this and then go into the game, you would know full well what the storyline is and everything that has led up to it. Even though... wouldn't playing the game be means enough to establish the story and what's going on?
See, that's the weird thing. But also, in a strange way, it's kind of old school for them to do this. Because if you remember back in the NES and Super NES days, when we had, you know, instruction manuals, the instruction manual had the preamble story in it. Almost always.
This is true. This is a very true point. Now, the weird thing is, back then, that was almost a necessity because of the limitations of technology and memory in those early days of video gaming.
Yeah. I mean, there's no excuse now, of course, but I'm not angry about this. I think I'm okay with this.
I mean, it'd be a weird thing to get angry about. It strikes me as just being weird, and it's very reminiscent, or at least makes me very reminiscent of a couple years ago when the property of Star Wars just became very licensed and turned into all different sorts of form factors, such as the different Lego sets, but then basing video games on those Lego sets, and then basing a TV series on the games that were based on those Lego sets. I'm recalling there was a Star Wars animated series, CG animated series, based on, like, the Lego Adventures of Yoda.
The Lego Adventures of Yoda.
Something in that vein. It was just a weird transition from one thing to the next, and I didn't understand it then. Perhaps I'm an old fuddy-duddy who simply yearns for a simpler time, but I didn't understand it then, and I don't understand it now, but nevertheless, Spider-Man PlayStation 4 coming out in September. The books will come out ahead of that in August.
Excellent.
Now that we've gotten the ludicrous lead-offs out of the way, you know, properly leading off with them this week, we can get into the meat and potatoes, what we're really going to sink our teeth into, even more so in continuing on from last week, the continuing saga of Billy Mitchell. Chapter 2.
Yeah, so last week, where we left off, was people kind of wondering when Billy Mitchell would respond, you know, will he do the Todd Rogers honorable thing and just kind of basically bow out, say like, okay, well, I don't agree, but you got me. Fair enough. I'm just glad that I had such a long career, blah, blah, blah. You know, be kind of courteous about it. Well, it turns out that wasn't the case. This is Billy Mitchell.
Shocking. Shocking.
This is Billy Mitchell we're talking about, of course. So he released a, actually, I think Old School Gamer magazine, or some guy who had a YouTube channel. It was some guy's channel. It wasn't like a branded YouTube channel or anything, but it was some guy's channel. And I think the guy was one of the either writers or contributors of somehow something for Old School Gamer magazine, which Billy Mitchell is on the advisory board for. They released a video on this YouTube channel of Billy Mitchell kind of rambling on. And, you know, there's a couple of sound bites in there that, you know, we'll read. I guess we could pull the audio, but I feel like it's not worth it for Billy Mitchell. A couple of the sound bites here that Billy Mitchell said, and I quote, "I've been asked to address things that are recently in the media. The fact of the matter is now there's a true professional due diligence being done to investigate things that happened as far as 35 years ago. In a professional matter, not in a shock jock mentality designed to create hits. We will show that everything that's been done, everything was done professionally." I mean, he goes on about how, you know, everything he's done over his 35-year video game record-setting career, everything was done according to the rules of the time, but everything kind of changed in 2014 with the new Twin Galaxies regime where, you know, they want to change everything, blah, blah, blah. Basically, his statement was less one of, sorry, I cheated, and I guess, you know, it flew back in the day but doesn't fly now that they're being more thorough, but it's more of a, I swear I didn't cheat. Everything was done up, you know, by the book, to the rules, to the letter of the law of the time. And then he goes on to say about how they're slowly collecting witnesses, documents, and all sorts of other things, and they're doing an investigation, and they mean being people involved with Billy Mitchell, and how, it's not in his hands right now, but we're going to get it soon. So he released this big rambling thing. There's a link to it on our website, thearcadeshow.com. And it's a thing to see, and it's also a thing to be kind of like scratching your head at.
It certainly was evident that he did not have any sort of PR person or communications professional helping him released this statement, and it was very much an ad lib type statement that he put out because it was filmed in the side hallway of whatever convention space he was in last weekend attending the Midwest Gaming Classic, and some person from the Old School Gamer magazine pulled him aside and they shot this, and it was ultimately posted to YouTube, because he does something very uncommon when there is a figure, some sort of public figure, addressing a controversy or some sort of negative claim that's been levied against them. Normally when that happens and the defendant, if you will, the person who is being alleged to have done things improperly, they will come out and they will staunchly deny that they had any involvement in the wrongdoing, that they themselves committed the wrongdoing, anything of that nature. They will deny, plead for clarity and whatever else, but they will deny. That is the main takeaway from whatever statement in these scenarios. They will deny that they are involved in the negative claims that are alleged against them. Billy Mitchell does not do that here. Not even in the slightest.
No, he doesn't deny anything. But he doesn't outright admit anything. But basically, like I said, yeah, the message that we got was basically he was doing everything within the parameters of the rules of the time. And he kept kind of, he kept coming back to the whole of the time thing, because he did mention the regime change, or the current regime of 2014 forward, which, you know, after Walter Day retired, I guess that sort of represented like an old era of Twin Galaxies, which I think a lot of the current community was not happy with, because it let crap like this go on, where it's like, well, Billy, like clearly there was people who had problems with Billy Mitchell and his claims on records for quite a while. I mean, for God's sakes, just the King of Kong itself shows how much of a douchebag he could be. And I mean, all of that editing and stuff aside, when Steve Wiebe had to kind of prove his record in person and prove his abilities in person, why was it that Billy Mitchell didn't have to do that and he could just come swooping in with videotape? Like that, those kind of things, even from like, you know, that long ago, which is only about 10 years ago, which is still a long time, but comparatively speaking in terms of like the career of someone like Billy Mitchell, who's been doing this since 1982, not that long, but yeah, it's just like that kind of attitude that was allowed to prevail for so long definitely left a sour taste in a lot of people's mouths. I mean, and I think what we're starting to see is maybe the unraveling of Billy Mitchell, because he definitely strikes me as the kind of guy who for years and years and years must have just been surrounded by sycophants or yes men, basically. People who just want to be in Billy Mitchell's aura, saying, oh, Billy Mitchell, we're so in awe of you, or like, whatever. And then now, those people are probably, some of them are probably waking up going, oh, this guy's a fraud, or this guy's a bit of a scam artist. Certainly, there's still going to be some around him just kind of going, oh, don't listen to those people, Billy, you're still the best. But I think what we're starting to see is maybe the unraveling of all of that.
I think that's entirely possible. There will always be devotees who are in that space around Billy Mitchell who will never turn their back on him, because they genuinely believe him to be the person that he tries to present himself as. How much the greater public buys into that, I don't know, and I don't think it's as many as Billy Mitchell would like, and that's going to be the problem. He is facing an uphill battle in this, public relations battle, if anything. He's not necessarily trying to clear his name, because it sounds like what he's going to attempt to do, we'll see whatever comes of it, but by claiming that he'll present all the witnesses and documents and evidence, he'll show that everything was on the up and up as the up and up existed 35 years ago, aka it was allowed because, you know, we were all the, you know, in the old boys club, so to speak.
But yeah, like, going on that note,
go ahead.
Sorry, I think on that note, it's just sort of, that's the problem here. Like, he's not getting the fact that, you know, it's not that people are questioning if it was okay then. They're questioning that what was okay then is not okay now. And they're determining, no, it's not. That's the point, and I don't think he's getting it, and I don't think he will get it, and that's the problem here.
Certainly for him, because he seems so steeped and set in the ways of 30, 35 years ago, the early arcade era, and so much of his notoriety and name recognition is based upon that time.
But back then was definitely a different time anyways. Completely. I mean, if the thing about now compared to then, especially within the last 5 or so years with Twitch and like speedrun culture really kind of exploding, if, you know, with Billy Mitchell, especially now, he would have to be constantly working on a live stream almost 24/7 to just kind of keep his record milliseconds ahead in the case of speedruns, or even a couple of points ahead in the case of these high score kind of battles. Because there's always going to be someone right on his tail, you know, either, you know, bettering him or equaling him constantly.
Oh, certainly. And likely doing it, if they're doing it by current standards, with a lot more transparency than what there was of 30 some odd years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Because back in the day, when Walter Day, you know, was in the early days of Twin Galaxies, it really was just Walter Day as the one adjudicator, the one point person who took it upon himself to make sure everything was on the up and up.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
But I wonder, really, if this is going to lead to what I was mentioning last week, of Billy Mitchell and maybe some others, perhaps Todd Rogers, going off and forming their own new sort of high score regulation and adjudication society, their own new version of Twin Galaxies that is more honest, more open, more transparent, blah, 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 blah. And they will form this new organization, and this new organization will authenticate and prove and demonstrate that all Billy Mitchell's old records are A-okay.
And then no one in the current speedrunning / record scene is going to accept it. They're all still going to say, no, this is just continuing the problem. And then again, they're not going to get it. Billy Mitchell's not going to get it. He's going to say, he's going to be surrounded by his sycophants that like pump him up and say, oh no, but you're doing this right, Billy. You're on the up and up. You're okay. And then he's going to go, yeah, well, what are these people's problem? Ah. And then it's, I don't know, he's such an unlikable character, and it's just so hard to kind of, as my nickname at the start of the show said, it's really hard to feel even a little bit sorry for him, or even to really like him. It's easy to just accuse creative editing and whatever else for, you know, that whole, you know, like, 10 years ago with the King of Kong. Cause fine, like, you know, like I've seen enough movies, I've seen enough documentaries where, like, you know, I know how things can be manipulated, and I know how editing and music cues and things like that can really change the tone of something or someone. But he's doing a pretty good job of proving that they didn't really have to do much for that movie these days.
No, and, this is the public persona he's cultivated for years. He's put, you know, time and effort and some modicum of thought into maintaining this public persona when he's at events, he's conducting interviews or doing any sort of public engagements. This is how he presents himself as, and it always seems to come off as an unlikable individual. And this is the real big problem he's going to face. If he doesn't realize it now, he will realize it down the line as he keeps this battle up, because he will keep this battle up, is that this is a public relations battle, and he's going to lose by virtue of the fact that nobody likes him, or I should walk that back a smidge and say, not many people outside his inner circle like him. The greater internet, the greater high score community do not like him. No. And the thing is, this is all about arcade high scores. It is not life and death in the grand scheme of people's lives. It doesn't really matter. So the only way that you can maybe gain any sort of traction is to be a bit more of a likable figure, gain the positive sentiments of the public at large to have your message be heard and more accepted rather than outright dismissed as, I mean, ultimately, to some extent, what we're doing with his statement that he released on YouTube last weekend, where, I mean, it was nothing. It was 90 seconds of just fluff and words coming out of a humanoid's mouth.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, like, I feel that, like, yeah, that it really is a public relation thing at this point, and if he wants to salvage any bit of his image, he should just do the right thing and congratulate Steve Wiebe on being the first legitimate million-point score, because everything that Steve Wiebe did was legit. They have hours and hours of legitimate footage of him playing a real machine. It's in the goddamn movie, for God's sakes. And for him to just kind of swoop in with that tape was, like, really, frankly, just a dick move. And it was, super dishonorable. Like,
that's true. And for it to have been accepted into Twin Galaxies for consideration, as it was also tremendously dishonorable on the part of the adjudicators at that time. But in his statement, the thing that struck me is he keeps saying, you know, going back 35 years ago, well, some of the shit he pulled, as you just mentioned, the tape where he just rolled into competition with of him playing on a Donkey Kong machine, and that just took all the wind out of Steve Wiebe's sails, that was only 10 years ago. So what is there that exists 35 years ago that he feels the need to prove and exonerate?
Yeah.
Or demonstrate was okay by the standards of 1982.
Yeah, because they did actually prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that the tape that he brought in for the King of Kong, that whole schlamazel display where he refused to do it in person but brought in the tape, thus slapping Steve Wiebe in the face, that was done on MAME, which did exist 10 years ago. Like, there's frame comparisons between legit hardware and MAME and different versions of MAME, and they did determine which version of MAME he was using. Like, it's irrefutable evidence. Like, there's frame problems and stuff that exist with different versions, and they went into all of that. So, he's been exposed. Him doing, like, and that was 10 years ago, like, that's the biggest thing, too. Like, you mentioned, 10 years ago. This thing happened 10 years ago, you're disqualified. What does it matter if you go back 35 years? What does it matter if you go back 200 years? I mean, video games weren't around then, but still, you know, like, it doesn't matter. Like, you've been caught cheating once. Nothing that you say is actually going to be relevant. And, you know, like, there's no reason to trust you at this point. So you could salvage a bit of your image and go, I've had a big, good, long career and I just really wanted to keep it going for a bit longer. But, you know, I got to do this and that and hand it to Steve Wiebe and my hat's off to you and thanks for the career. I'll see you at the next convention kind of thing. Like, he could still be, like, you know, a public figure. Because he really was, like, the first esports celebrity, if you think about it that way.
Oh, he was. He, I think, was one of the first names of a game player to gain any sort of mainstream pop culture-type recognition.
Yeah.
I feel like the longer this goes and the longer that Billy Mitchell draws this out, again, he's going to draw this out, everything in his that he's presented publicly and how he carries himself says to me that he's not going to go down without making more of a stink as time goes on. But the longer this goes on, it seems to me that if there's ever a day when he has any sort of awakening, any sort of moment of enlightenment, where perhaps he wakes up and just something in that moment as he gets himself ready for the day just strikes him and he realizes he's wrong, that he's been wrong to go about it the way he has, that he maybe shouldn't have carried on for as long as he did and made as big a stink as he did, that if ever there's a day that he wishes to atone, that he will need an ever increasingly bigger display of humility and atonement to Steve Wiebe and the arcade community, the arcade high score community, the longer he draws this out.
Yeah. No, like we keep bringing up Steve Wiebe. I mean, if you've never seen The King of Kong or don't know the history, you might wonder like, well, why do we keep doing this? Surely the scores have been beaten by now. Yes, they have, but the point is Steve Wiebe was the first one to get the 1,000,000 points. Legitimately. And it should have been a big celebration at the time, but Billy Mitchell swooped in with his tape and kind of took all the wind out of his sails, and it kind of like, kind of, I think it made, was a big like point of dejection for Steve Wiebe, where it was just like, well, I did my best and I guess he's better than me kind of thing. But, which, you know, is, you know, at least he was a good sport about it. Like, well, just watch the movie. If you've never seen it, it's a good movie, but yeah, it's like, it was really like not cool. Like,
here's the crazy thing. The Donkey Kong high scores that Billy Mitchell and Steve Wiebe just kind of traded back and forth for a while, those were all surpassed by, I believe, Hank Chen a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I believe those were subsequently beaten, but and then Hank Chen engaged in a almost a hot potato of high score championships with another individual whose name escapes me at the moment. But Hank Chen was never as public and out there with his the high score Donkey Kong title the way that Billy Mitchell was.
Yeah.
It is possible to have high scores in Donkey Kong and other arcade games and not be a total douche about it.
Yeah, it's possible to do all sorts of things without being a total douche about it.
And I'm trying to wonder, and I'm trying to think through in my own head, and perhaps you can give me any sort of insight or your thoughts on this, but are we able to glean at all from what Billy Mitchell has put out in his statement and what we know of Billy Mitchell to be? Are we able to glean what his end game for this might be, what he's trying to accomplish if he carries this out? Is he trying to clear his name? Does he think he'll exonerate himself and solidify and perhaps restore his legacy? Does he feel he's been made a villain by Twin Galaxies and he'll perhaps paint himself as the one done wrong by through all this, or what?
You know, I have no idea, but if anything comes of this, I think it's going to be, if anything comes of this, it'll just literally just be maybe Billy Mitchell, possibly Walter Day, starting their own new Twin Galaxies or something like Twin Galaxies, where Billy's records are literally all not just stricken from the record as being cheating.
Where the new organization acknowledges basically all of the old records and anything that Billy Mitchell does going forward.
Yeah. Like that, if anything, that's the only thing I could see coming of this, because he's acting like a villain from wrestling. Like and there's no reason for people to act like that in real life. Even villains in wrestling are usually good people in real life. Like it's all literally just an act. There's no reason for you to be like that. And like, it's real life that Billy Mitchell lives in. Like I understand some trash talk while you're in the heat of the moment or maybe in a competition or something, but if you're just making public appearances, there's no reason to be a jerk for no reason.
And any sort of comments you offer publicly or anything like that, there's no reason you should come off as being unlikable unless you are genuinely trying to be unlikable. It's all mystifying, and I think the only real person who knows or understands would be Billy Mitchell himself. And the crazy thing is, he could be known as a successful businessman. He does run his, I think it's Ricky's Hot Sauce or some sort of hot sauce company,
yeah,
which he's been in charge of for a number of years, and it seems to be doing well and providing some sort of living for him and his family. And that is something that is worth, you know, being notable and making a fuss about. Arcade game high scores, to me, that's not really worth it, but instead this is what he is out there about.
Like, if anything else, like, it should be a fond thing to look back at and go, yeah, back in the day, I was pretty awesome at Donkey Kong. I used to be in this magazine and that magazine, and, you know, I was sort of a villain in this movie because this guy was trying to dethrone my record, and, man, that was some good times. But, like, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm having a hard time understanding, but I guess there was one final piece of Billy Mitchell things that happened with his records. You know, after all of his records were stricken from Twin Galaxies, finally the Guinness World Records Organization will be removing all of Billy Mitchell's Donkey Kong scores as well as his records for Pac-Man from their database as well, because the Guinness World Records Organization views Twin Galaxies as their eyes on the ground in the video game world, and they trust everything that they say just explicitly without any sort of second guess. So not only has Billy Mitchell's records been stricken from Twin Galaxies, they're also no longer going to be in any future Guinness World Records books of any kind.
And this is not without precedent. This is the same tactic that they used earlier this year when Twin Galaxies struck down the records of Todd Rogers for the Atari game Dragster.
Yep.
And I mean, understandably so. Guinness World Records can only go out there and verify so much. If there's a well-established organization with understandable and transparent means and processes of verifying these things, it's easier just to go with that.
Yeah.
So Billy Mitchell's record and legacy has really taken a hit over the past week. And the longer he draws this out and tries to authenticate his legacy, his records, and say he did everything on the up and up, the more I can't help but think and look at him as Paul Di'Anno, the original singer of Iron Maiden, who will forever let you know he's the original singer from Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
Like, at some point, you have to let go, don't you?
Well, Paul Di'Anno still tours those first two Iron Maiden albums around, and, you know, there is always shaky cell phone footage of him making homophobic remarks, you know, calling the guys of Iron Maiden this and that and whatever else, and comparing Bruce Dickinson's voice to, you know, whatever kind of homophobic remarks, for whatever reason, because he's Paul Di'Anno and he thinks that that's cool in 2018. And yeah, but, oh yeah, that was the one other stray observation about Billy Mitchell that I wanted to make. Not related to Paul Di'Anno necessarily, but we did look up, decorum surrounding the American flag. And there is a thing called the U.S. flag code, which we looked up. There's a website, collinsflags.com, which I saw a blog post where they ask, can you wear the American flag as clothing? And, you know, it's like, should you / can you wear as clothing? And they actually point out a part in the U.S. flag code, which says the flag code addresses the impropriety of using the flag as an article of personal adornment, a design of items of temporary use, and item of clothing. The evident purpose of these suggested restraints is to limit the commercial or common usage of the flag and thus maintain its dignity. Which, as you know, like, if you've ever seen pictures or video of Billy Mitchell, he's never without his American flag tie. And in the video that he released, he was also wearing an American flag handkerchief out of his pocket. You know, like that little triangle thing sometimes that you see guys wearing suits have out of their pocket. It was an American flag thing matching his big obnoxious American flag tie. And I just, yeah, I think you pointed out, is that right? Are you supposed to technically be wearing an American flag like that? like, I thought it, like, it was only really cleared for servicemen and women and stuff to be wearing a pin or some sort of adornment if they're military or whatever. Like, this doesn't really seem right.
It's not, but it's ultimately a voluntary flag code. It's not really enforceable by law. It's, I guess, just all up to the individual. And
not to be, you know, too invested in this, I am not an American, and I can't really say that I have any, like, too much of a horse in this race, but still, it just seems a little bit kind of awkward to always see that. Like, why is he that part of his image as well? Like, what's he trying to do with that? Be a bad guy and also have an American flag wearing it around? Like, what's he trying to say?
No, I think it's the opposite in his mind, and I look at that, and it strikes me as him trying to send the signal that he's a good guy. He's the face. He's the all-American. He's the hero by virtue of him being so patriotic and demonstrating that patriotism by wearing the American flag necktie.
I see.
Yes. Yes. In his mind, he's not the heel. To everyone else, he is the heel. He's the wrestling bad guy. But in his own mind, he's the hero.
Oh, man. See, we ended up ranting about Billy Mitchell for another 20 minutes this show.
Oh, it's so easy to do. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about next week about Billy Mitchell. It's been a while since we had this continuing antagonist on the program. It's been, what, a good 10 years since the whole Jack Thompson schlamozzle with the hot coffee mod in Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah, where we used to call him the exploding bag of wieners because we refused to use his name on the air. That was back when we had a radio program.
Yes, back in the long ago days. What bygone days those were.
Yes.
But, yes, good old times. But, let's move on and talk about some more current video game news and happenings. And, a word of warning to anyone who is out there in the Minecraft universe. If you have been partaking in some skins this week, if you've been downloading any skins for Minecraft on the PC off the official Minecraft website of Minecraft.net, you should be concerned and perhaps running various or proactively running various diagnostics, malware detection scans, virus scans. Just basically give your computer the whole sweep of, is everything okay with my machine? Because it was revealed by cybersecurity firm Avast late this week that malware was contained inside skin files that were hosted on Minecraft.net.
Yes, the official Minecraft website.
Yes, the one controlled and moderated and overseen by Mojang. Yes, that one that everyone has full trust in, that they're not going to get sketchy files and whatever else because it's a Mojang-controlled website. Yeah, well, there were sketchy files on there.
Yeah, so if you're wondering what this malware does, it's a pretty malicious one. Avast says that it's designed to reformat hard drives and delete backup data in system programs, and it can send messages to infected users' email inboxes, like a very charming, and I quote, "You are nailed by a new computer. This is a piece of shit." End quote. Very, very, very sophisticated virus / malware. And thankfully, the folks at Minecraft.net have addressed the issue, they say, in a quote from a spokesperson. They say when they contacted IGN, I should say, and I quote, "We have addressed this issue and put additional measures in place to protect our community. We encourage players to report any suspicious activity to feedback.minecraft.net.
Now, I'm kind of wondering, if you're able to offer any sort of developer perspective on this, or as much as you can, given that you're not involved in the infrastructure or the behind the scenes of Minecraft's website or the skins, but how the hell would something like this happen?
Well, there are ways to manipulate files to look like other types of files, file headers, things like that. And typically things like this are, it's literally just people figuring out how to break things using other things. So in this case, it's, you know, all you need is an attack, like, when you're developing a system like this, you want to keep your, what they call attack surface as small as possible. So if you have like a website that collects user data, you really, you know, you don't want to have multiple parts on your website that collect user data. You just want to have one. You want to have the one portal so that that's the only thing you have to worry about. And even then, you want to make sure that you're validating all your different types of data and stuff, and you're making sure that people aren't, you know, sending things through that could do damage to your heart, to your databases or whatever else. And I mean, file uploads to a server typically don't do much to the server because servers don't typically run, you know, the same types of software that personal computers would run. Like, there's no graphical interface to speak of on a server usually. So if someone uploads these PNG files, like, you'd think, like, the worst that's going to happen is they'll look bad, right? As PNGs, like, maybe if they're corrupt files, they just won't look right. But clearly this person figured out how to, that, you know, maybe there's something that happens when the PNG file is read. Maybe Minecraft interacts with it in some sort of way where it actually executes it and does something on the system. And yeah, basically all they had to do is include some sort of malicious payload in this PNG file that essentially sends a command to the computer to erase everything and send a malicious email. So yeah, I mean, it's not impossible. Like, it doesn't seem unreasonable. It seems very unsophisticated, and I'm actually a little bit surprised that, you know, the upload mechanisms were not a bit more robust and there was not actually even a little bit of a QA process when you're uploading something like this. Especially if it's, you know, on the official website. If it's something being distributed from an official source, I mean, I can only speak to, like, App Store submission processes. I mean, I've submitted apps to, like, you know, iTunes before, and I've submitted apps to the Google Play Store, and both of those stores do have some degree of, you know, review process that goes in place. I mean, Google's a lot faster than Apple, but sometimes it takes up to 4 days for your app to be, you know, given the green light, the go-ahead, the thumbs up. And I mean, that's just sort of like the expectation that Apple has set up with people releasing apps. It's annoying sometimes when you have to get something out, but it's also kind of comforting to know that there is that process in place, because there is going to be a human looking at your app and going, hey, yeah, so this doesn't quite look right. For you to release the app, it has to work on this type of device. And then you go, oh, crap. Ah, okay, fine. I'm actually really surprised that there's nothing like that for Minecraft.net.
That seems like a lapse in security and safety protocol on Mojang and the Minecraft dev team end.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, there's, like, when you think of, like, money involved in the property of Minecraft, surely they could hire a couple of QA people, a couple of people whose job it is to actually just install and make sure things are okay before they're going through. Did no one install these skins or try them out?
That's a very good question. Only Mojang and the people involved know the answer to that. But this kind of strikes me of and takes me back to the early days, the Wild West and the new frontier that was peer-to-peer file sharing in the late 90s and early 2000s. Things like Napster and
Kazaa, you know, and ShareZaa, whatever.
Yeah, Grokster, I think, was one where you would click and download a file that you thought would be whatever song, whatever album, whatever video file. God help you if you're trying to download a video file in the day, that internet era, because that was before broadband.
Yeah. It used to take all night to download an MP3. So.
Yeah. And God, an album? Oh, had to be careful how you were doing that so you didn't tie up your computer for 2 days. But my point being, back then, files could be mislabeled or, you know, deliberately mislabeled, users misled, for very malicious means and, you know, click to go play whatever song you thought you had downloaded and, oh, you've launched some sort of virus or malware and you're locked out of your machine.
Yeah, exactly.
Or somehow you've opened up and allowed a backdoor into your computer and there's someone mucking around with all your stuff. So, yay.
Yeah. But, yeah, so I guess that website is there if you do, because I guess they want to put it on your head. So if you have any sort of problems or notice anything suspicious, go to feedback.minecraft.net and do their job for them. But on other Minecraft, in other Minecraft news and goings on, there's actually a kind of interesting thing, an interesting, I guess, a cross-play opportunity that's happening right now, where if you have, or when you get Minecraft on the Switch, you'll actually be able to earn Xbox achievements while playing on the Switch.
Yeah, this is an interesting little thing we found out this week when Microsoft was talking to Alex Newhouse and the other staff of GameSpot.com. They confirmed what was suspected, that by virtue of the fact that the crossplay between the Minecraft, or the version of Minecraft on Switch and the version of Minecraft on Xbox and PC, because they can crossplay, but that is all enabled because of logging into the Xbox Live account. Ultimately, Nintendo deferring and allowing, well, Microsoft to handle that aspect of things, that along with it comes the ability to earn achievements in the Switch version on your Xbox account.
Yeah.
Apparently, this is going to be, and you'll also be able to accrue gamer score points and basically everything that you would normally be able to do or receive, in terms of your Xbox Live account, on your, as if you were playing the game on Xbox, you can do on the Switch. This is going to be implemented in the upcoming Bedrock update, and that Bedrock update has already come out for the Xbox One, PC, and mobile versions of the game. It will come out to for the Switch version later this year. But yeah, that's a neat little thing that I don't think anyone really anticipated being a thing, something being enabled, when crossplay was announced for the Switch and Xbox versions of the game.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense that it would work, but it's really weird that it works that way. It's like, it's strange that Microsoft is opening that side of their infrastructure up to other companies to just kind of, you know, use it, basically. Like, I think it's really, this really is Microsoft maybe trying to really extend an olive branch to everyone to go, hey, see? We want everyone to play together. It's just a thing. Ah, we have a big, we're the good guys now. Like, it would be like earning PlayStation points every time you play a game on Xbox or something. It's weird, but cool. And, you know, interesting that you won't have to earn those trophies across multiple platforms. If you earn them once, like you just have them, it makes sense.
It does. It just seems like an unintended side effect. I mean, a positive side effect, an unintended consequence with this, and it's certainly a neat thing. And I wonder if this will open the door to more crossplay opportunities between players on Switch, players on Xbox, and I mean, the holy grail would be to have Sony come around and ultimately allow crossplay on the PlayStation platform between either Xbox, PC, or Switch, or all three of those.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't seem likely.
It's not likely. Sony seemed to be the company that was very icy towards the idea. But, you know, there's stranger things have happened, which is a saying I like to throw out a lot on this program because we've seen some pretty strange things happen.
This is true. We have, and I mean, hell, if we were talking, say, a year and a half ago, would you have thought that we'd see Nintendo turn around their fortunes to the degree that they have, all based on a machine that shipped without any sort of established online infrastructure, without video streaming services like Netflix, without any sort of online multiplayer or classic game service?
No, but
yeah,
but here we are.
this is the world we're living in, and Nintendo clearly making a concerted effort over the past couple years behind the scenes and outwardly with the Switch to just do things a bit differently. And news that you may not have heard about came out late last week that we're just going to touch on now that ties in with the idea of Nintendo doing things a bit differently. This one takes us to San Francisco and Silicon Valley, because that's where Nintendo is teaming up with a venture capital firm known as Scrum Ventures. And this new partnership between the two of them is going to have this, or basically have Scrum launch a new program that will scout for startups and have them work on new ways to play or use or come up with new ways to play and use the Nintendo Switch. So Scrum is going to be looking either for startup companies or teams within larger companies, so like maybe a division of Google or maybe even some R&D facility at a university, large or small, and I guess enable them or work with them to develop new tools to improve the Switch platform, such as components, hardware, or even additional add-ons. And Scrum and Nintendo will provide outside developers with assistance to bring their products to market, but neither Scrum nor Nintendo are actually going to be directly investing money into these firms. They're simply going to be providing assistance. And what we should clarify here too is this is all hardware-based. There's no assistance. This isn't a software play. It's not so some small firm can get their game onto the Switch easier. It's all about hardware, all about the physical interaction and usage of the Switch.
Yeah. So, very interesting idea. I mean, it's obviously has nothing to show for it yet, but it's interesting that there's a VC firm involved, and that could lead to a lot of very interesting things.
It is, especially if you're going and nosing around in Silicon Valley, where there's a lot of smart and creative people working on hardware.
Yeah, and, you know, especially, like, with seeing things like Labo and whatever else is kind of has been revealed to us with Nintendo's plans, if that's just sort of what they've come up with, if that's the sort of thing they're looking at, I'm pretty interested to see where we're going to see the Switch go in 5 to 10, well, not 10 years, but, you know, within the next 2 to 5 years.
That's true. And Labo, I mean, it's literally just cardboard and origami, but with a gameplay aspect. That seems like the kind of thing that is maybe in line with what they're looking for or what would come out of this program that they're starting with Scrum Ventures. Just some weird idea that you wouldn't have openly considered. And kudos to Nintendo, the very old company that's been around for 100+ years, to actually be out there and looking and soliciting new talent, new ideas, fresh vision, if you will, for the hardware side of things, instead of just playing it safe and doing the same old playbook, if you will.
Yeah, exactly.
Clearly there are some new blood with some new ideas at Nintendo, and this will bear some fruit. I'm sure of it. There's too much talent out there in Silicon Valley and other parts of North America to be left behind by this. So basically Scrum is going to be the one to go out there, basically be like a pig looking for truffles in the woods, if you will. They're going to go nose around. They'll work with these early development companies, and they'll be the ones to then bring stuff to Nintendo later on and pitch Nintendo these ideas. Within, I believe, 6 months is the time frame that I read, though I could be wrong on that, but that's my understanding, is 6 months. But if anything comes of this, we will let you know. And I'm sure there's going to be NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, out the wazoo over this, so highly unlikely anything would leak.
Yeah, but, you know, there's always a chance. But
and if it does leak, we will be all over that.
Yes, exactly. But this is not a leak. This is just kind of, you know, not great news. If you were looking forward to playing Dark Souls on the Switch, on May 25th when the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One versions came out, because up till recently you were expecting that the Switch version would be out in the same day. Well, unfortunately, it's being pushed to later on in the summer of 2018. So, too bad.
And not just the game, the Amiibo as well, the Solera of Astoria Amiibo, has been postponed to the same time frame of later summer 2018.
Yeah, so not the greatest, but you know, that doesn't affect the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One versions, so if you have one of those other systems, you can still praise the sun on May 25th, play the classic Dark Souls with a bunch of people, new people on new system, and hopefully experience Blight Town without crazy frame rate issues, which I'm looking forward to.
This is true. The rationale and reason given for the delay of Dark Souls on Switch is the same old thing we hear every time. Needs more time for spit and polish.
Yeah.
But one last news item to get to on this week's program. Kind of a weird story and something we don't often consider, but as we are in an era where the bigger, more expensive video games will quite often license music, previously released music from artists, or solicit an artist to and commission them to produce all new music for their game. Interesting that late last week it was reported that Rockstar Games will actually be removing a bunch of songs from Grand Theft Auto 4 from the soundtrack, the in-game soundtrack to Grand Theft Auto 4. Reason being, the license agreements on those songs have run out. Apparently it was a 10-year agreement for a number of songs, mostly affecting the Vladivostok FM station in the game, so a lot of European and Russian pieces of music will be removed because they were on 10-year agreements, or at least the publishers of those songs had 10-year agreements with Rockstar Games. And Grand Theft Auto 4 launched back in April of 2008.
Yeah.
It's been 10 years already.
Yeah, it's very kind of crazy. Weird that, like, this is not something that I necessarily anticipated ever happening with these games, but I guess Grand Theft Auto 4 would have been of the first generation where maybe the soundtrack to the game wouldn't have been included on the disc and would have been something that you would have had to have downloaded an update. So it's very possible that, yeah, if you even wanted to listen to those songs again in-game, you maybe couldn't, because there may have been some sort of online aspect always required to grab them.
That's true, too. In a statement provided to usgamer.com, Rockstar said of this situation, quote, "Due to music licensing restrictions, we are required to remove certain songs from the in-game soundtrack of Grand Theft Auto 4 and its episodes, in particular a large portion of the Russian pop station Vladivostok FM. However, we are replacing some of those songs with a new set of songs on that station. We will update our customer support website with new information as soon as it is available," end quote. So they're losing some music, but they're signing new agreements to replace it with other music.
Probably far cheaper music.
Where they have longer license terms on it, too.
Yes.
Interesting that this is, I guess this is just a reality of our current and modern gaming age. We're going to run into this. Maybe more and more, depending on who signed what and the publishing rights between the, music publishers and the game companies.
Yeah. Very interesting. And, I can't help but like smugly look at some of like the old like disc only games that still have licensed soundtracks, like, you know, Road Rash and stuff, and look back at it and go, yep, we're never losing those Soundgarden songs from there, or whatever, like, or, you know, some of the old Tony Hawk games, like, oh, nope, that Primus song is intact. All those tracks by Fishbone, intact. Like, like, Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, oh yeah. Anyways.
So if the rest of the music world falls apart, we still have those to hold on to.
Yes. Oh, man.
But at this point, we should probably get into our final segment of the week, which, if you've been listening for any period of time, you know is the Blast from the Past, the portion of the show where we like to take a couple minutes to celebrate things that are enjoying milestone anniversaries, things that you may have heard of, may have seen, may have played, may have enjoyed already, or did not know you would enjoy until we spoke of them. That's also a wonderful aim here, too. And we have two items that there's every... I'd say it's a 50-50 chance you've either know of it and have seen them or have never heard of it and never seen them. It's going to go either way with both items. One is a movie, one is a TV series, one is young, one is very damn old. Where do you want to start? I think I have an idea where you want to start, but I'll let you say it.
Well, I think we could probably start with the newer of the two.
Okay, I was wrong. I was totally wrong. I thought you would go older, but we will start younger. The younger of the two takes us back to the early aughts, if you will, the early 2000s, because it was April 19th of 2003. That was an interesting time in television because one American cable channel had recently rebranded itself. If you were in, I believe it was on our package back then. It was previously known as TNN, which for a long period of its existence, it was the Nashville Network, a country music-oriented station.
Yeah.
Then it eventually changed to the National Network and tried to gain a broader, more national audience, literally in its name. And then it was rebranded to Spike TV and given a specific focus as being the first network for men. That led to terrible programming such as Stripperella and a series with John Christopher Lucy doing Ren and Stimpy cartoons again, which really tarnished the legacy of Ren and Stimpy, but we won't talk about that. But we will talk of one of the great successes to come out of that time in the early days of Spike TV. This is Most Extreme Elimination Challenge, otherwise known as MXC.
Yeah, so, you know, I guess both of us were the target demographic for Spike TV right in that time when it was sort of in its heyday. And some of these shows, like, I can't help but think that they just sort of were very kind of formative shows. I mean, some of them were just really dumb, like you said, Stripperella and whatever else, like, basically, like, the dumb TV equivalent of like reading all the non-ad parts of a Maxim magazine or something. But, you know, then you had things like MXC, which was like maybe like a interesting precursor almost to some parts of our internet culture now, where it was, they took this show called Takeshi's Castle, which was one of those crazy Japanese game shows, from actually quite a long time ago, from the era between 1986 and 1990, starring Beat Takeshi, who was like sort of like a pretty well-known Japanese entertainer at the time. But they basically took all the footage from it and then just dubbed over it with ridiculous, you know, obviously fake names, fake things that people were not actually saying, basically just dubbing over it being ridiculous. So you got like the, you know, the crazy, like almost like YouTube poop kind of, dubbing coupled with, the cuckoo bananas nature of this original, Japanese game show. And it all just sort of worked. It was funny. It was entertaining. It had 5 seasons, believe it or not. And it was one of those shows that always felt like it was on, like, if you were going to turn on Spike TV, there was either a good chance you're going to watch, you know, Star Trek The Next Generation, some form of wrestling, or MXC. That was just one of the three things that was always going to be on. Unless I'm remembering wrong, but I think I'm not.
No, that is certainly in line with my recollection of that time of Spike TV as well. Especially Star Trek The Next Generation. That literally was an entire afternoon of programming. But once you got into the evening time, I don't know if it was deliberately planned like this by the broadcaster or just because of our CRTC regulations, the American feed may have been airing something that would not have been allowed, or some other Canadian broadcaster had the rights to, and so the Spike TV feed would just always be reruns of Takeshi's Castle. That could have also, or not Takeshi's Castle, MXC. Excuse me. So that may have been a scenario as well, but regardless, this show was always on, and it was one of those shows you could always tune into and be entertained by.
Yeah. It wasn't anything that you needed to have any sort of background to. It was just whatever you're watching at the time was all you needed to be watching. Like, even if you tuned in halfway through the episode, it didn't matter. It was just like, you were going to be, if you had 5 minutes to watch TV and MXC was on, well, whatever 5 minutes you're watching, it's going to be pretty funny for 5 minutes. Not like brilliant comedy, not like, you know, like nothing to the level of like classic Simpsons or like anything super noteworthy, like an old Mel Brooks movie or something. But it was like, you know, just ha-ha funny for a couple of minutes. Like, wow, that's really dumb. And also interestingly enough, I'm looking at the Wikipedia page. The opening theme was a song by Bumblefoot, which I had no idea, which I am a big fan of Bumblefoot. So another reason to like MXC.
Indeed. And what I enjoyed about MXC was that was the humor style, and even more now, because you can easily go find clips and whole episodes on YouTube. I mean, if you want the whole DVD collection, it's out of print. You're going to pay through the nose. Stick to YouTube. But it was dumb, but it was the kind of dumb where it wasn't egregiously dumb. It was silly, stupid humor, but it wasn't overly so. It wasn't terrible, like, jock humor or anything like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't completely debased, lowbrow humor. It was silly. It was lighthearted and, very inoffensively, though sometimes offensively and somewhat gross, silly humor, but enjoyable. And the thing I found too is, and talking about it too with a coworker of mine who's very much into the show and loves it, and we can easily talk about it at the drop of a hat, is that you really got a sense, and maybe more so now with the aid of time, but you got a sense that the people writing it at the time didn't have many restrictions on them, and they could just kind of write whatever they wanted in terms of the English dubbing and the lines for the English voice actors to read. And they were just kind of left to their own devices, even from the network. Like, it didn't seem like they were given notes. They just kind of wrote it all to entertain and amuse themselves.
Yeah, that I think that's fair to say.
And it was hosted by again, here's the contrast between the very Japanese visuals of the show and the, you know, English North American dubbing, hosted by two men in very brightly colored and gaudy kimonos named Kenny Blankenship and Vic Romano.
Yes.
One always playing the role of the more straight man, one the kind of colorful character, your on-field host, doing the sideline reporting was, Guy Ledouche. Your judge referee for each, competition was Captain Tennille.
Yes. Then they had a bunch of recurring characters, like Danny Glanz, Skanky, Chief Auto Parts. There's a lot of like really dumb characters, basically. But yeah, like, it's set up
like everything. And each character, each competitor on the show had a different stupid name.
Yeah, it was like really just like an excuse to get as many dumb puns or like really like it was really a lot of puns on current celebrity names and stuff out there. It was really sort of like where it was, you know, where it was going in terms of humor. But
and even if you maybe didn't enjoy the humor, there was something interesting about just watching the visuals of, I mean, granted, it was an old Japanese game show, but it was kind of before you had shows like Wipeout. So this was the first time you really saw competitors going through a competition and looking like they were getting seriously injured.
Yeah, and I mean, if anything else too, it might have been like an interesting lighthearted gateway into watching some of these crazier, more intense Japanese shows. Because I do remember as well, sort of around the time that MXC was sort of first airing, that I remember getting really into watching the original Iron Chef. which if you haven't ever seen the original Iron Chef, like I'm not talking about Iron Chef America or whatever that Bobby Flay stuff is. The original Iron Chef was one of the most unnecessarily super intense cooking shows you'll ever see. And it was hilarious because of it. Like everything was like amped up to 11 with how serious everyone was taking the things, and just the English dub was very similar in my mind to MXC, except it was genuine. And that I think is like the interesting thing about a lot of like Japanese culture, that it's not too far for them to go from it being genuine to being as ridiculous as MXC. Like it doesn't take a lot, which I think is one of the crazy things. Like the tone is very kind of similar as well. And I don't think I'm, you know, speaking inappropriately to say that.
No, I get what where you're coming from, having watched the very Japanese version of, or the original Japanese version too of Iron Chef when it first started airing, in Canada, at least on what we had for Food Network back then, before the concept became totally North Americanized. And everything was ridiculous and over the top. And when you're that ridiculous and over the top, you can go two ways. You can be stone cold serious about it, or you can be lighthearted and silly. I mean, in the case of MXC, that's the lighthearted, silly approach. Iron Chef was the stone cold serious approach to that level of over the top ridiculous.
Yeah. But,
And this, if you're somebody who subscribes to the bad lip reading videos on YouTube or things of that nature, that style of humor, MXC was bad lip reading before there was bad lip reading.
Yeah, even though like, I mean, they didn't go to the degree that bad lip reading does to actually match people's mouths exactly with what they were saying and stuff. But, you know, like some of like the just random exclamations that they had people say, especially just before getting knocked off some tall platform into a bunch of water or something, was always hilarious. Like, so definitely worth watching.
Yes. And there'd always be two teams, at least conceptually on the North American version MXC, there'd be two teams of, wildly different jobs, like meat handlers or accountants, you know, baggage handlers versus, I don't know, celebrities, that kind of thing. All the competitions had ridiculous names. And yeah, there'd be a lot of Japanese people just getting crunched in whatever competition. So if you're curious about that, it's well worth checking out MXC on YouTube. You can find it. It's very easy to find, either short clips, full episodes. It's very easy to fall down that rabbit hole too, so we encourage you to check it out because it celebrates, it's the 15th anniversary of its premiere on Spike TV this week. But let us now time travel back to April 19th of 1973, 45 years ago, to a fete and discuss a movie that tried to be a post-apocalyptic sci-fi, but was very limited. And we are quickly approaching the period of time that it was set in. We are talking about the movie that you and I both enjoy because of how special it is, Soylent Green.
Yes, Soylent Green, the Charlton Heston vehicle. Well, one of the many Charlton Heston in a totally overacting capacity vehicles that he was definitely a part of, you know, throughout the late 60s into the early mid-70s. And beyond, really, but like this was sort of in that sweet spot in and around kind of Planet of the Apes, the Ten Commandments and whatever else. This movie is bananas. It's insane. And it's
from the very start of it, it's insane.
Yeah, like right from the start, I mean, I'm sure there could be a whole how did this get made episode be made about Soylent Green, like right from the start. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I want to say that all of the problems, like it's supposed to be sort of a dystopian future where the unemployment rate is like just skyrocketing. Like the majority of people on the planet are unemployed and people are living in cars and you know, there's not enough food going around and whatever else. And, you know, Charlton Heston's character is supposed to be a cop in, I guess it's New York or some kind of major city. But yeah. So, oh, that's right. So here we are on Wikipedia. They say, just right from the plot, the 20th century's industrialization led to overcrowding, pollution, and global warming due to the greenhouse effect. In 2022, 40 million people live in New York City. Housing is dilapidated. Homeless people fill the streets. Many are unemployed. Those few with jobs are only barely scraping by, and food and working technology are scarce, with the most of the population surviving on rations produced by the Soylent Corporation. Their latest product is Soylent Green, a green water advertised to contain high energy plankton from the world ocean, more nutritious and palatable than its predecessors, red and yellow, but in short supply. So, of course, throughout the movie, you see, like, people lining up for Soylent Green and blah, blah, blah. But also, I just need to look up the actual current population of New York City, because 40 million doesn't seem like that crazy of a number.
No, and the way they portray that number in the movie is it looks like it's an absolute crush of people, as though you really can't move throughout the streets of New York without bumping into just a constant stream of bodies, just bodies everywhere, on the sidewalks, in the streets. Rooms have, in apartments, have dozens of people to them. And granted, they're trying to make it look like the worst case scenario. But the interesting thing is the way they portray all the worlds, because the very start of the movie is with basically a preamble of the history of the world, but it's trying to be a post-apocalyptic, a futuristic sci-fi, but the future only goes as far as when the movie was released, so the history of the world preamble at the start of the movie only goes up to the early 70s. This movie is set in 2022, so we're coming up to 4 years away from it, from the horrible future it envisioned, and they couldn't have guessed, you know, 50 years ago that, you know, it would look like it does, because they guessed it would be a lot worse. And this is just a general point I'll make. It's something that you and I have spoken about. I think born out of discussing this movie, but it's a great point if you're ever doing any sort of writing, directing, or creative effort involving a piece of futurism or some fiction set in a futuristic world, set it in the far future so that there's no possibility that your audience that you're releasing your product to could ever live to see that future you're writing about.
Yeah, like, make sure that anyone involved with the movie can't possibly be alive when the year actually passes. Like, Zardoz got it right. Zardoz is a terrible movie, but it set itself in, like, the year 2700 or something. So, you know, no Sean Connery is going to be alive to be embarrassed about that weird unitard he had to wear.
Yeah, but no one's going to be cracking jokes to him in the year 2700 and being like, hey, you know, where's your unitard, Sean Connery? Where's your, like, knee-high leather boots?
Yeah, but also, just for the record, the population of New York is currently 8.6 million, with the surrounding area being roughly 21 million. So,
okay.
So about half of that of, you know, Soylent Green, whatever thing, but yeah.
There's still time. There's still 4 years.
Yeah.
There could be a boom in people.
But regardless, I mean, weird, unexplained societal problems aside, it's definitely, it's a movie that has a lot of strange ideas. I mean, they seem to think that, you know, we as humans would deal with overpopulation in a lot more kind of, I want to say just giving up type ways. Like, I think it, like, as they showed at one point, it's not uncommon for people who reach a certain age to just kind of, you know, go through the process of euthanasia for themselves in a very bizarre kind of artsy scene that we ended up seeing.
Yeah, it's not quite the more, you know, boring medical methodical approach to euthanasia. There's a lot of
Like pageantry.
yes to this. I mean, like, very much what you would have seen from, like, a 60s type movie as well. We see it because the character played by Edward G. Robinson in the movie, who's friends with Charlton Heston's character, you know, just kind of, he's done. He's cashing out. He's calling it a day, and he goes to the process to undergo the euthanasia. And, like, you're put into a big room. You're lying on a bed. There's, like, some Omnimax screen right in front of you, and you're seeing images of, like, you know, lush green meadows and rivers and streams and all these just beautiful type nature scenes that I guess don't exist in that version of a future.
Oh, also, Soylent Green was Edward G. Robinson's last movie.
What a note to go out on.
Just like to point that out there, but the meaning of the movie becomes clear in the very last line of the movie, which I'm not going to say what it is because it's definitely a spoiler, but it's something you figure out really quickly that it takes the character, well, Charlton Heston character way too long and everyone else way too long as well. I think actually no one else figures it out by the end of the movie, but you'll figure it out right away and you'll wonder why everyone in this weird 4 years from now future is so dumb.
I'm gonna say malnutrition, because there isn't that much nutrition in the Soylent Green. I don't know. It's not a particularly good movie, but it's ridiculous enough to be entertaining, and you come away with something to laugh at least, and talk about.
Yeah, it's one of those kind of cultural talking points that has sort of been referenced by a lot of comedy since then. Futurama especially has referenced Soylent Green quite a lot of times. If you're a fan of Futurama, it's worth at least watching Soylent Green once to sort of get some of the references.
Well, even beyond that, you should probably just watch it once in as a general rule of existence, and so you can say that you've seen it and know what that vision of a future in the 1970s looked like, and also what the world history was up to like 1973, because you get the whole rundown at the very start of the movie, and then it's set 50 years in the future, which, oh, there's 50 years of history that isn't covered.
Yeah. I mean, also, if you are a fan of just, you know, watching Charlton Heston in his classic overacting style, which, I mean, you can consider him one of the greatest actors of all time, fine, but if you're not admitting that he's overacting everything he's done, you're wrong.
And that's true. This is around the hate, you know, the time of his Planet of the Apes roles as well. So he's in his sci-fi overacting prime.
Yeah. Just like everything is just delivered with admittedly a ton of gravitas, but also like a weird unnecessary swagger and just sort of everything is way over the top and every single line is delivered with such outrageous conviction. And it's like, you're a cop, dude. What do you, your character shouldn't be this, like, this weird.
Yeah, I kind of needed to dial it down. A cop shouldn't necessarily be that intense all the time.
Oh, like, man.
It almost feels like he delivers each of his lines with his teeth just clenched and his jaw about to shatter.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man.
But it's still an enjoyable movie, and it's a hell of a thing to watch, and if you make it all the way to the end, and if you've never had the very last line of the movie spoiled for you, well, then hurry to watch this movie before you just accidentally come across it or anything of that nature, and enjoy it on your own terms. Soylent Green, which came out April 19th of 1973, it's a hell of a movie. It's an experience, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
And it's at the opposite end of the spectrum from what we spoke of before that, MXC, Most Extreme Elimination Challenge, which premiered on Spike TV April 19th, 2003. By God, that's a good show. I miss it. you know, I feel like it'd be prime time for a reboot, a return of MXC, but, then again, we have the internet for those things as well, so.
Yeah.
Who knows? But, we always want to hear your thoughts on MXC, Soylent Green, Billy Mitchell. Where do you see Billy Mitchell's saga going or ending up? Let us know your thoughts on that and everything else and anything else. You can email us info@thearcadeshow.com, or you can send us a message via Twitter and follow us. We are at The Arcade Show, and like our page on Facebook, send us a message there, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. And if you want, you can also do it in the reviews as you leave us a review on our iTunes page and our Google Play podcast page. Direct links to both of those available on our homepage of thearcadeshow.com. We encourage you to subscribe and get this program directly delivered to your digital device. That's a lot of D's. I don't think I'll attempt that again.
Good.
But that does it for this week. We thank you so much for joining us and hope you can join us again next week. So until then, good night, everybody.
Good night.